Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number 555. 555. It's 555. It'll never be 555 again. It feels like it should be a special number, all fives, or like a jackpot, or some large coins should spit out the bottom of whatever device that you're listening to the podcast on. Oh my god, a Nerdist Podcast slot machine. That's never going to happen. But if it did, Matt would give all his money back to it. Because he can't help himself. At Midnight this week has a pretty fantastic lineup. Of course, it's on At Midnight on Comedy Central. But this week we have Moshe Kasher, Donnell Rawlings, Jesse Joyce, Rob Riggle, Rob Hubel, Owen Burke, Kurt Brownaller, Jason Biggs, Doug Benson, Steve Agee, and more. So watch At Midnight after Colbert Monday through Thursday on Comedy Central. Also, if you're open to listening to some new podcasts, we've got a ton of other ones on the Nerdist Podcast Network. You might want to listen to Cashing In with TJ Miller, or Competitive Erotic Fan Fiction, or the Nerdist Writers Panel with Ben Blacker. There are many, many to choose from, so if you just go in and put in Nerdist Network on iTunes, then a bunch will come up. Or go to the Nerdist.com website and look for some stuff there. This episode is the return of, well, it wasn't Spoon before, it was Divine Fits before, but Britt Daniel and Alex Fischel of Spoon came in. We went to the Swing House Studios in West Hollywood, and we talked for a bit, and then they played a couple songs, and we bonded some more, and so this is a fun story musical episode of the Nerdist Podcast. By the way, Spoon, which is one of my favorite bands, by the way, their new album, They Want My Soul, is out tomorrow, which is Tuesday, August 5th. So pick it up. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 555 with Spoon.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, I never like to warn people because I don't. I don't know. I just like to have a conversation, and I feel like it feels weird because you, whenever you're doing something, it's probably really focused on whatever the thing you're working on right then is. So it's just like the same five things, and then your brain probably just ices over, and this story and this story.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. You get this rap.
But then it's also hard because you're touring and you're thinking about your shows and you're also trying to get whatever you have to do in the immediate future. And do you ever feel like your brain just sort of separates? You're like, this is the part of my brain that's saying words and I'm not really checked in on that right now.
That sometimes happens and it's a creepy place to be. I do not like that. I like to be present.
Yeah.
But yeah, that happens. It's happened in shows too, you know, where it's like, wait, what am I doing up here?
What's any of this?
The show must go on.
Where are we?
It doesn't happen very often, but
I feel like when you're at a live show, your audience will basically, they're cool with whatever as long as you're honest with them.
Right.
So you can say, I completely lost my train of thought. And they'll go, okay. But the more you try to cover up for it, they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Someone's trying to trick me.
Right. That's true.
How did the Divine Fits tour go, by the way?
We did a lot of different tours. How did they go?
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
The shows were fun, yeah. They were wild.
Yeah, it was a different type of band. I mean, I'd never played with any of these guys before, for one thing, in a band with those guys, the Divine Fits guys, and just Dan is such a charismatic sort of beam of light that can, you know, carry anything, you know, like on stage. So it was kind of cool to be able to just like sit back and let him run things sometimes, you know.
But then did you start to get itchy for like, I'm kind of ready to go back and do some more of my own stuff after a while?
Wait a second. We've started, haven't we?
We did!
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of a thing where we always knew we were going to come back to Spoon after Divine Fits was done doing a record and doing a tour.
Yeah.
I just said it and it was, that was in the works the whole time, you know.
What number album is this for Spoon?
8.
This number 8?
Yeah.
I mean, did you ever think, we're going to make 8 or 10 or 12 or infinity of these?
No, I sure didn't. I don't think I was thinking that even like a couple records ago, really. That sounds like a big number.
It's a big
number. What kind of bands put out 8 records?
Tight bands.
How many records did Zeppelin put out?
I don't know.
Six, I think.
Six? Just six? Wow.
No, they did more than six.
Seven.
I think they stopped. I always get lost.
It's around there.
Yeah,
we're approaching that territory at least.
But I kind of wonder when you start writing or you start putting stuff together, even if your intention is to, this is going to be for another project. Does it go? Oh, but this feels like Spoon. Does it sort of get kicked back there?
I haven't really had that issue, but it's usually because like when it's time to write, it's time to write. You know. You know, I'm busy a lot of the time. And so then at certain points, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I'm going to need some songs in about 2 months. Maybe I should start writing some.
Do you approach it like are you able to approach it like a job? Like, I'm going to write from 9 to 5, and then I'm going to have dinner and go to bed? Or do you just write constantly?
I'm kind of working constantly, yeah. It's hard to set aside.
Not 8 hours a day. Yeah. Some comics are really good at that. Like, they can write like it's a job. But for me, if I get an idea at 3 o'clock in the morning, I have to get up and like I got to make a note of this because I'll never remember. Do you remember stuff in the middle of the night that you go, I'll remember this, and then you wake up and you go, what the fuck was that idea?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All the time, especially melodies. You're never going to keep melodies if they come to you in your brain. That doesn't happen to me very often, where it's like a melody just pops into my brain without singing it, you know, or trying to write a melody. But when it does, you got to put it down fast because it won't stick with you.
Every time I convince myself, like, there's no way I'm going to forget this. There's no way. And the next morning, I'm like, I think I forgot the best joke I ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gone forever, and I have no idea what it was connected
to. Sorry, Icarus.
Yeah, the wax melted.
And there's something about looking for it when you know it's lost that it's going to prevent you from ever finding it. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Your brain's like, no, fuck you. You had your chance, and you decided it would be better. How dare you rely on me?
Well, mister, I can't find a pen.
Do you record into your phone? Do you sing into the phone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you get to write much when you travel? Like, or is it sort of once you get home, then it's in
It's usually at home. I mean, I've gone through phases where I've tried to do it on the road. I know some people can do it, but I don't know. You're usually so busy trying to figure out where you're going to get a shower and where you're going to eat and then how do you get to the sound check? I mean, it's just like you're in more sort of like hunter-gatherer mode, you know?
Do you feel like your most meaningful, like stuff that is the most meaningful to you, does it come to you that way? Or do you go, I have a deadline, I just have to get this thing out, and then when it comes out, you go, oh, wow, that was actually way deeper than I was prepared.
Well, you know, I'll be taking notes the whole, you know, all the time, whether or not it's time to write or not, you know? So if there's, like, an idea for a song or an idea for a word, you know, like lyrics or a melody, yeah, you can jot that down, but the real work doesn't really happen for me till it's time to, like, we're going to need something here soon. That motivates you, you know?
So you like deadlines?
Yeah, I think so. What would we do without a deadline? We'd still be working on the record, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Well, because if you have all the time in the world, how do you know? Then you get to tweak forever. There's no sense of urgency to, like, we got to tighten this up. You keep judging.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not a good headspace.
It's not a good headspace at all, because you don't. Are you hard on yourself when you're writing? Are you pretty much like, this is it and it's fine? Do you prejudge stuff? Do you ever do this thing where you go, you start to write something, you go, nah, that's dumb, or do you go, you know, I'm going to see where this goes?
Usually, I try to see it through, and then there's a lot of. I think everybody in the band is pretty good at knowing when something doesn't stand up, you know. So you can put out a lot of ideas and then just go through and find the ones that work, you know?
Yeah. And has that process gotten easier with this band after 8 albums?
No. Not really. Certain things get easier, but...
What's your, like, ratio of, like, stuff you put down and get in there and do all the way to finish for recording before you, like, are like, oh, this one's not working? Like, and does that just eat away at you?
Well, I don't know, but there must have been like another 40, 50 song ideas that we had for this record that we never even really investigated.
Do you go back to that stuff?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. I know that there's bound to be 2 or 3 gems in that 40 or 50, and I'll probably, next time it's time to write songs, first thing I'll do is listen to those.
Do you use that as like a starting place for the next record?
It can be, yeah.
Sometimes you have ideas that your brain emotionally isn't ready to deal with yet. Like, there's the seed of something, and then you're like, I don't know. And then you get a little bit older, and then you have a collection of experiences, and you're like, oh, this makes total sense now.
There's one song on the record that we tried doing for Gimme Fiction, which is a long time ago, And the song was pretty much done. I'd say 80% done. And we, Jim and I couldn't agree on a kick drum pattern and sort of, you know, like we, I kind of wanted it to be this like, like kind of dance kind of feel,
mm-hmm.
or just at least like that, what do you call it? Four on the floor kind of, yeah. It just like, propulses the whole song. Drummers hate that. So we couldn't see eye to eye on that, and then we, all these other songs came to us and we put it aside, and then, you know, whatever, 8 years later we were back at it, the same song again.
And you're still having the same conversation?
No, we didn't. It didn't, it kind of naturally came to us without having to get into it. That, like, about half the song has that beat and then half doesn't. So I guess it was a compromise.
So you made a nice compromise.
We didn't discuss it, but it just kind of happened that way.
I mean, is it, I would imagine at this point there must be some certain shorthands that you guys have with each other. Or do you find yourself, does it feel like, oh, this is the same conversation we're having, you know, eight records in, we're still having these same
conversations. I know that there's certain things that I am going to suggest that he'll always hate. Yeah. And vice versa. He always wants to do the Smith sort of like,
oh, right.
That?
Like a shuffle?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
like
something
a two
like
hi-hat? Two hands on the hi-hat?
Yeah, two hands on the hi-hat. I don't like that beat so much.
What's and you keep trying to mash in this kind of four on the floor
drum beat.
Right. Yeah. But maybe that's what, you know, maybe finding that balance between those two things is kind of what makes everything sort of hold in, you know, in kind of a nice stasis where it's like, oh, the balance of these two forces actually make this work.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right about that. And the combination of two aesthetics, I think, is almost always going to be better than just one aesthetic.
Yeah. You
know? Unless you're working with someone who is completely wrong for you. But, I mean, I've been working with Jim and most of these guys for a long, long time, you know. So,
do you ever, do you go off and write on your own and then go, this is what we're, or do you guys... Do you present ideas and then as a group?
A lot of it is me writing alone and then coming up with a demo. And then if I get real lucky, then the demo is just like some hot shit demo that we just kind of completely imitate or build on top of. But I'd say most of the time I do a demo and I bring it to the band. And I say, how are we going to do this as a band? And we discuss that quite a bit. There's a new, like on this new record, there's one that Jim and Eric wrote and I just sing on top of. Like that's a new thing for us.
Do you like doing it that way?
Yeah, I did like it, yeah, because I never would have come up with that kind of song. It's called Outlier on the record. It's number 6. And we've just never had a song like that before. How would you describe it? Dancey?
It's a bit dancey. Yeah. Well, we had
it's
a tech that said it would be huge in Southern America, South America. Because he lives in
not
Colombia
in Texas,
now.
Right.
Yeah,
not
Southern America, very different from South America.
South America. He said that We need to push that song because it'll be a hit in South America.
Yeah.
Does your playlist change when you go around the world? You go, oh, you know, in this part of the world, these types of songs pop more. But in America, we tend to put these out in front more often.
Maybe for the warm up music.
Yeah.
But not for the set, probably.
Not for the actual set.
Yeah.
Are you on tour right now?
We've been doing shows all through the summer, like mostly weekend. You know, we do go to a festival or go do a run of a couple of shows, that kind of thing.
So once
the real tour starts in September.
Right. So the album's out August 5th. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right?
It's August 5th, right?
Yeah.
So once that...
Yeah. I couldn't remember if it was 4th or 5th.
It's a
Tuesday.
There's
all kinds of things we've been talking about that are happening those days.
So once that happens, like once the album... I mean, you're basically just in the, well, it's done, so now we just have to go around and present it, and that's it. Like, or do you still feel like, no, the things are still evolving, even though it's technically already done?
Of the songs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that they do keep evolving, and then sometimes they evolve so much where you're just, like, bummed that you didn't record it that way, but you just got to let songs live, you know? And if you come up with some great part for it or new avenue for it, then you just got to... play it that way.
Live album.
Yeah, I guess that is what live
never before
are.
Heard presentations of your
yeah,
favorite
that's
songs.
That's true. And I've never liked live albums, but that I didn't really see the point of them, but maybe that is the point of them. You let the song progress and then you record this different version of it.
It's funny because I don't really feel like as a listener I don't have a hard and fast rule. Some songs I just want to hear. It's kind of funny to go see a band play a song exactly the way it was recorded.
Right.
It's almost like you're testing them. Like, I want to see if you could do this. The way I heard it. And if they played exactly the way, you're like, yeah, that's the fucking song. But then other times...
I like when they change it up. Like, I'm a big fan of that.
That's what the way it should be,
because I bought
though.
The album, so my thought process is, all right, let's see what we're going to do with this now. Like, you know, you've already spent this time with it. Let's see what you're playing with it now.
Oh, shit, Britt brought bagpipes.
And then just totally just slowly back out of the venue.
Yeah, and doesn't every audience member want to feel that the performer is present and there with them and doing something that's unique to that setting and that night? And
yeah. You definitely got that vibe. Like, some bands you just watch, and they're like, oh, they are powering through this. I've been real bummed when you see a band, like, both nights when they're somewhere, and it's the exact same show.
Same banter.
Banter. The banter is the worst.
My heart once. Yeah. I heard them pick the same fight with what's obviously an invisible audience member so he could look clever. I'm like, no.
Who was that?
That was Social Distortion. It was a real bummer where he was just like, and made the same joke, and part of me died. I was like, oh.
There's something really wrong about
that. That's like having a significant other call a new boyfriend the same pet name. You're like, you can't do that. Mm-mm. I was special. And then you realize, like, no, I wasn't really. But, you know, do you like going to see music anymore, or is it hard to go be an audience member?
No, I love seeing music. I wish I got to see more of it.
So what when you're watching, what's your experience as an audience member? Are you watching analytically, or are you watching and just kind of
silently judging?
I wouldn't have done that.
Just probably the same as you, you know, just go to have a couple drinks and you hope that there's something that's going to make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, you know? Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
What is that lightning in a bottle thing? Like, what is that thing that happens? Like, you can, you know, there's so many moving parts. So many things kind of have to fall in line for a show to feel like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? I mean, it's hard to plan that. I mean, you can game the system as much as possible. If you're super rehearsed, everyone knows the beats, you feel loose, you feel comfortable. But what do you think that sort of that ingredient X is that makes a show like, holy shit?
Dank nugs. I don't know. I don't know. There's no answer. It's a lot of things lining up. Like, the audience has to be ready. We have to be ready. Everyone has it's like meet halfway. I don't know. But when it happens, it's great.
When you have 8 albums to choose from, how do you decide which ones to go back and cherry pick? Does that change, or does that set say?
There's just certain ones that you know you can play real well. There's certain ones that. You know that everybody wants to hear, and then after that, maybe you just pick out some just to be weird, you know? That's something you haven't played in 3 or 4 or 5 years.
For you, like, you have to have them, you have to play some for you.
Yeah. Well, for me, I love playing the songs that, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, just, you play the songs that you know are going to be good. You know? And, I don't know what. I just feel like we've never really had a point where we were playing songs we didn't like, but
that's got to be such a weird thing for a bit. I just can't stop thinking about The Police. It's like, okay, you're getting like $1.5 million a night or whatever it is. You all hate each other. You're sick of these songs, but like, what? How do you? How why is it so difficult to just come to just fucking play the songs and just get along for a couple weeks and then you can go back to your lives?
How hard can it be?
Yeah. I don't know how. I don't know.
I mean, think it's $1 million per EO and then just go home.
but I guess there really is that thing. It's like at a certain point it's just not worth it. Like, how do you infuse the freshness into the relationship that you have with the music and I guess each other as a group if it isn't quite naturally there at the moment.
Yeah, and I think part of the way you do that is by just how jazzed you get about being in front of an audience, you know. That is the sort of unknown that's going to make every, you know, that, you know, we will rehearse these songs for weeks and weeks before we went on tour, and it kind of got a little like that it's not inspiring. But you get up on stage in front of some people and you can be inspired immediately.
Yeah, it was crazy because we had rehearsed for like 2 weeks and then we played a show like after taking like a 3-day break, 4 days, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And then we played our first show and everyone was playing different. I was like, what the fuck?
You actually do play the song.
Yeah, it's like, this sounds nothing like it did in rehearsal. This is fucking awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
Not the rehearsal sounded shitty, but.
Maybe it sounded shitty.
Maybe at times it may have sounded shitty.
But you kind of need to do all the mechanical parts and then step away and then it just kind of like gets into your nervous system. and then you're just not. I think I would imagine like once you can take the thinking out of it and get your brain out of the way, like once it's in your fingers, that's
right.
That's
yeah,
probably
that's what the rehearsal's for, right?
Yeah,
you get it so that you have some motor memory.
Yeah,
and then you go and try to find some magic in front of people, you know.
And then all out of nowhere, you throw a bitchin' Marty McFly guitar solo just in the middle, and just see how everyone deals with that.
Right?
Because I saw a friend of mine. I went to see Buck Owens play like maybe 8 or 10 years ago, and he was at the, I think it was the House of Blues. And this friend of mine was knew a guy in his band, and the guy said, and his band were like world class musicians, and they said, and this guy goes, yeah, we never know like what key or tempo Buck's gonna play. He just that starts, rules. And then we have to follow him. We have to keep up with him. So they're basically, it just sounded like every night is a steeplechase for him. They right. have no idea what he's gonna play or how he's gonna do
I
it.
I think that's how Chuck Berry does it too. You know, but he's working with
his,
bands.
His setup's crazy because you have to supply him with a band.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
he's
that's
playing with people.
Full
he's never
back line,
with.
And then they just know the set list ahead of time.
Right. Not sure what key it's gonna be in, mm-hmm. or the tempo, or when which song is gonna start when, but. I've seen him play a lot of shows, and they are loose.
Yeah.
the first time I saw him, he actually recited poetry in the middle of the set. He was on. He recited poetry, and like his own poems, and he also did a duck walk. And then I've seen him more recently where he's just not – wasn't his night. Like I think he was really drunk the last time I saw him. He had to have been.
He's also pretty up there.
He is up there. But the first time I saw him was not too long ago, and it was. I just think that he has on and off nights, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's also at a certain point, you're just sort of like, I'm me. You can either like this or you don't. Like, it's not, I don't think he's really. He may not be doing it for the passion anymore. Right. It's just sort of like, you know,
it's
I got to
imagine like that. Like all the songs you're playing were written 50 years ago.
Yeah,
like that's an insane thought process. Walk on stage. All right, here's a bunch of stuff from more than halfway through my life.
Yeah.
I mean, he literally could be asleep, and his mouth is just still spitting out all the everything.
But yeah, I think that's why it's fun for him, though. The same thing, like you're playing it in front of this unknown, an audience, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen while you're here in front of them on the stage, and that's what makes it, you know, interesting for him. And that's why he probably plays one show in his hometown of St. Louis a month. You know, he has this regular show that he just does, no matter what.
You ever think about mixing it up so that people would leave a show and say, like, did you see the Pyrotechnics at the Spoon concert? have you ever thought about doing anything like theatric, like any
lasers,
like stage theatrics or anything weird?
Not really.
I have.
You have? But tell us what it's going
to
be like.
We should talk about
this. Break down the stage. What do you got? Give us the vision.
We're just beneath the stage, and Jim comes out first. He just starts Rent I Pay.
That is a good look when someone can come up from underneath the stage.
So
I've seen Prince do that a couple times.
He comes up, he's already playing.
Oh, yeah. He starts
and
playing
then
underneath the stage.
Just lights on him, right?
Right.
And then you come up, you're playing your guitar.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once it hits, everyone just kind of like somehow poofs on stage with when your vocals come in.
Right.
Somehow. An effect of poofing on stage.
Does he fly in over the audience and land, and then everyone poofs on, or does he just...
No, he's coming out from under the stage
also. From under the stage too, okay.
Me?
You know, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So Jim
right.
comes, then
like
you
that.
Come, and your thing's kind of twirling as you're coming up.
Uh-huh.
And you're playing the guitar.
Now hold on, let me write this down.
Yeah. I heard twirling.
Uh-huh. Your cylinder is spinning while you're coming up.
Okay.
And then so like... Then once the song hits, everybody else kind of poofs there with like tons of flames.
It's all about poofing.
That's there's like, a lot of poofing and flames. Yeah, I love that you've thought very detailed.
About I don't know. I just think it would be awesome.
One time.
You go Kiss-style gimmicks as the show goes along, or like a Queen disappear, reappear?
I could do I think a disappear, reappear would be kind of cool. Yeah.
I think it'd be kind of fun because no one would fucking expect that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I think you do two nights in places, and you do one normal stripped-down indie rock band and then one crazy stadium rock show with no self-awareness that there's two different shows, just playing both real straight.
I think you start with the stadium rock show, and so everyone's like, you're not going to fucking believe that they... And then you just act like that didn't happen
right.
the next night.
What are you guys hoping for?
A Michigan J Frog situation. Like,
no, man, Spoon is crazy now. Yeah, yeah. Would you play something?
Yeah, we can do that.
That would be great. I think it'd be fun to since we're in this music studio and there's instruments over there, I think it might be kind of fun to play a couple songs. And then,
bye, Ben.
I hope, yes, we tricked you into giving us a private concert. I hope that's okay with you. That's the first time.
I enjoyed that.
So, what was the name of that song?
Inside Out.
What's it about?
Yeah, I don't know. Can you tell us what that one's about? I don't know what that one's about.
Really?
Well, it's about holy rollers. It's about true love.
No, you don't have time for them?
Yeah. It's about, you know, real feelings versus the feelings you were taught to grow up with, you know.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Let me. This might be personal, so you can tell me to fuck off. I feel like we're probably around the same age. So how do you feel now versus, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago? Like, do you feel more comfortable with yourself, or do you feel more comfortable? Do you kind of feel like, I'm a grown-up now, or I feel like I have wisdom, or do you feel comfortable? Do you still feel like, there's something missing still, and there's a hole I got to fill? Like, I don't know. How do you feel in your skin now?
Well, I feel comfortable, and I feel wiser. There's still a lot of things that, you know, but I still feel driven to try to do things.
Yeah.
And to try to get better.
Yeah.
I think people do get wiser as they get older.
Because, you know, when I was 25, if you had said, hey, look at this guy who's, 42. You'd be like, what an old, who the fuck, get that guy. But then you start getting up to that age and you're like, I feel like me. I'm not, you know. So do you still feel the same way when you're 60, 70, 80 years old?
This is something I've been talking about a lot lately. Because when I was, you know, 16, 17, I pictured myself dying or offing myself by the time I got to be 30. You know, where I grew up, I didn't know of any 30-year-olds who were, like, living interesting lives. You know? It was everybody seemed kind of dead.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, that was sort of a short-sighted way. You know, eventually I, like, got older and I saw that, oh, yeah, there are people who are still, like, present and, like, involved with the real world and, you know, like, interesting things are still happening to them. But it's like there's still that part of me that's like, what the fuck? You know, this isn't supposed to happen.
Right.
Remember me? Like, this is, you know, I still recognize that guy's still in there somewhere.
But you're
16.
Yeah, you're like you're still are that like 25.
I just got my permit.
Oh my god, that's so great.
Yeah,
we'll go do donuts in the parking lot. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't. I feel like it's a good thing. I mean, I don't feel like I was that reflective when I was younger. I feel like it's a good thing. I feel like there's a strive for, I don't know, depth or something more interesting or something more personal. Do you feel like the stuff that's coming out of you now is more personal? When you look back on the older stuff, you're like, oh, that was all superficial.
Oh, music?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I do feel like, yeah, it was totally the stuff when I first started. When I first started out, I didn't think there was anything cooler than, you know, Wire and Gang of Four. And
you were right.
Yeah, those bands, they're very cool. But there's not a lot of personal insights going on there.
True.
I still love them. But, you know, it's at some point, I think around the time that sort of like my life started falling apart, maybe, I discovered that, you know, like this thing of writing songs where you kind of express vulnerabilities and like what's really going on with you, this can be powerful and handy, you know, and fun.
It seems like there's a migration from writing from a standpoint of, oh, writing is this thing I go do, as opposed to, you know, I was just having a conversation with someone today about, and I tried to simplify it as like, you know, there are action verbs and there are being verbs. And when you're younger, I feel like you employ a lot of action verbs. You're like, oh, I have to go do this thing, because you don't know who you are yet and you're not comfortable being, mm-hmm. you know? So the stuff that comes out of you that's more personal, that you, when you're younger, you're like, oh, that's you know, that's dumb. That's just a thing I felt or went through. And it's like, no. But that's actually what's really interesting, not some external thing that you have to go in search of.
Right.
So are you really feel like now, like that's, that it, does it feel more seamless in that way now than it used to?
As far as songwriting goes? Or just life?
Just, well, let's start with songwriting and then go to life.
Oh, boy. I feel like it's easier, and I definitely, you know, I got more, you know, like I say, like around the time that my life started falling apart, I got a lot more accustomed, familiar with those sort of unpleasant feelings, and realized that, like, you know, some of my favorite records are ones like Plastic Ono Band, where people are talking, you know, where John Lennon is talking about pain, you mm-hmm. know, that's been real helpful, you know, that's, I think that the records did get a lot better around that time.
Do you feel like it's necessary? Do you feel like it's necessary to have?
No, you can make a party record, and that can be life changing too. You know?
Yeah,
both. You don't have to, but personally, for me, I enjoy it more now. You know,
I agree too. I think the party records are fun, but this is going to be a generality. But party records are fun, but the records that stick with me through, you know, oh, I love this record, but then I stopped listening to it. The records that I still listen to are the ones that are more emotional, I guess. The ones that I can connect with in that way. You know, there's always songs that's like, oh, this is a good song. I'm having a party. I'll put that on. But then there's the records that I find myself wanting to go listen to.
The by yourself records.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And, I mean, I sort of feel fortunate. I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I sort of feel fortunate that we have a way to deal with shit that a lot of people don't. That when horrible things happen, you feel bad for a little while, but then you start spitting it out in some way. You know, for me, it's joke writing or doing this or whatever, and you know, and you do what you do, and then, but you don't. But a lot of people don't actually have that, and so they just. I just kind of wonder, like, how do most people get their shit out if they don't have like a some sort of metaphorical canvas to be like, blah.
Yeah, a lot of them don't, right?
Gun range.
Exactly. That's where they get it out. Yeah, or it turns into like getting in fights on the weekends or something or whatever. You get a lot of tension and energy, and you got to do something with it.
Have you ever written something when you were writing it, you were like, this is the most moving spiritual song I've ever written, and then afterwards you hear it and you go, oh my god, oh Jesus Christ, what was that? Because it was just like too on the nose.
Yeah, too literal or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's happened. Yeah, there was one on this last record that we never really got. That song, Satellite, I thought was like, for some reason, it had this emotional depth to me that I was really feeling at one time. And then we just never could finish it, you know? What happened?
I like that one.
Yeah.
So it's not
maybe
on,
on the next record.
So yeah. It's just out there.
We have like a quarter of it recorded.
Yeah.
So it's literally a satellite just floating out there waiting to be turned on again at some point in orbit. How long is your tour go once you guys go back out? Does it never end?
Hopefully a long time.
Yeah, you know, we go out for like the first one, the first real one starts right before the beginning of September. It'll be like 3-4 weeks. Then you're home for a week. Then you go out again, maybe in another country for a couple weeks. It's always kind of like stopping and going. But like in all, I don't know, usually it's like a year or something.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But it's fun.
That part, well, it is fun, but do you ever just think like, you know, I just want to sit on my porch and stare at the ground for a while.
Nah, man.
I don't want to be alone with my thoughts.
No, there's times when it does feel like, okay, I could use a break now. But for the most part, I find that like touring is, there's something actually calming about it because of what we were talking about earlier. That's just about getting a shower. It's just about finding where you're going to get food.
Right.
You had this. You know, itinerary.
Yeah, you have your daily schedule. You know what you got to do, where you got to be, when.
In that sense, it's calming, or it's not so trying on your brain, right?
Right.
It's more trying on your body, probably. But
and then you get to go play a show.
Yeah, because it's distracting.
And every night you've got that thing. It's just like it's just a blast.
I had a vacation recently. And I didn't know what to do with it. I don't really ever get time off.
Uh-huh.
It's like,
where'd you go?
I didn't go anywhere. I
mean,
what do I do with Tuesday? Like, I know I don't ever have those questions.
Right.
And it really scared the shit out of me.
Be honest, you hosted at midnight in your house.
I did not host at midnight in my house.
Just stuffed animals, points.
I literally, like, I mean, this sounds so sad. There were points of the day where I was just, and I just moved into a house, and I don't really have any furniture. I was just like walking around this empty house in circles. Like, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Like, I must have looked like a fucking zoo animal.
Right.
And I was like, I should be out in the wild, but here I am, and I don't know how to wild away.
Grow out your beard and pee in jars.
That's what I should do.
What are those zoo animals thinking that are pacing back and forth?
Oh, what a life! This is so great. I think they think that. I think they think they're visiting the zoo and they're seeing all of the we are the displays to them.
I hate seeing that though. They just look. There's something going on in their heads.
I pray that their short-term memory, and I know that this is not the case for a lot of the higher mammals, but I really hope for them is that they're essentially like goldfish, and so that they just don't know that they're going in the same circle, and every second is fresh to them, so they don't. But I know that that's not.
I imagine they're constantly plotting revenge.
You think that's what's happening?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's kind of what it looks like.
Most definitely. Oh, I'm just walking in this circle. Y'all all gonna pay one day.
They're concentrating as hard as they can to try to evolve opposable thumbs or the ability to build complex machinery, so that they
grabbing all those phones that have fallen in and learning the internet.
Yeah. What's the strangest and most esoteric thing that you've ever written about? Because I feel like there's a song in here somewhere about being the animal in a cage that is trying to while away the hours.
Oh, I don't know. Most esoteric song I've ever written? Shit, man. I don't know.
Well, just think about this thing, you know, for the next record.
Back. Yeah, all right.
If you want, you know. If
the
you
record just, the if satellite's on. We'll also have a record about the animals that rise up and kill. Maybe that's how that song ends.
Alex, do we have any weird songs? Lyrically weird songs?
I don't know.
Yeah, nothing's
weird.
Coming to me.
Yeah.
Nothing. It's not filed that way in my brain.
Do you feel like
if Dan was here, he would know.
Do you feel like Brian Wilson was the least ironic person in music or the most ironic person in music? When I just hear about like singing about his favorite vegetables, I go, that's either the least ironic song or the most ironic song I've ever heard in my entire life. And I can't decide which one it is.
I think it's least.
Or like Free Design. Have you ever listened to the Free Design?
What's that?
The Free Design?
Oh. No.
Dude.
You're missing out.
Free Design was like a late 60s kind of like, I think it was like a sibling jazz trio.
Yeah.
And they did these really insane complex harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
But their songs were about the most literal. They have a song about kites.
Uh-huh. It's just called Kites Are Fun.
And it's just about how kites are fun. And there's
the thesis is in the title.
That's it.
Wow.
But the song is so beautifully. Now I gotta see if
now I'm, is it good music though?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy listening?
Well,
to it?
I, you know, I weirdly do, but it does sound like super 60s. I mean, it sounds like super 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 kitschy 60s. Let me see if I can pull. I know I have Kites Are Fun on here. Here we go. Kites Are Fun. Let me see if got an email. you guys want to cover this, like, no one's going to blame you.
Kind of sounds like the end of the dude.
They're just flying kites.
And you two both knew about this.
Yes.
You didn't know about this?
No.
How did I miss out?
Okay, here it's about to kick into high gear. I mean, as high gear free design goes.
Full bossa nova.
What are they saying?
Kites are fun.
Oh, yeah.
Kites are fun.
Yeah, so is that a joke or not?
No.
I don't think so.
I don't think so, yeah.
They caught the real tail end of that 60s, like, we can just be festive and there's no irony in this.
Right.
Festive.
Yeah.
It's a great way to put like, that.
They bought sweaters going, I have no ulterior motive with this sweater.
Right. Let's make all these sweaters match. It's basically like an awkward family photo in music
and
form.
And it's crazy because when you listen to some of their stuff, like the vocal harmonies are so complex that it's almost even more jarring that it's so squeaky cute because it's so complicated what they're doing on stuff.
Huh. They put a lot into those vocal harmonies.
It's almost like they were like, let's make all these harmonies as complex as possible. I'm like, oh, fuck, I didn't write anything about... Well, what? I'm holding a kite. Great, that's fun. Let's fucking go with that.
We have a song on our new record that kind of has a flute sound like that.
Yeah, it does.
Really?
Yeah.
Flute gets weirdly intoxicating, doesn't it?
It's a reverby flute like
that. Yeah, I can go with a reverby flute.
And it wasn't ironic when we did it.
It was not ironic.
Yeah, I was feeling it. I still feel it.
I feel it too.
I mean, I listened to fucking Aqualung loudly. Like, Jethro Tull rocked the shit out of the flute.
They did rock the shit out of the flute.
But no one has really since.
Once you've got Tull, I mean, there's no one's going to, like, we're going to beat Tull.
It's time, though. It's been decades.
That lasts.
There's an OC song I like that has a flute on it.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's called Meet Step Lively. I think it's a flute. It sounds like a flute.
Help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a flute.
Yeah, it's that's a wicked sound.
And it's just like reverb flute in the background.
Yeah,
it's
like,
fuck.
I think it's hard because there's no way to make a cool face while playing flute.
There have been some great one-offs of flute, but no Tull. There's been nobody can replace Tull.
How many songs were you guys willing to play during the podcast?
We got one more planned for you.
You have one more planned?
Yes.
Do you want to save it to the end, or do you want to do it like
whatever?
I kind of feel it now.
You want to do it now?
Yeah.
Oh man.
Okay.
Is that what you were not about to?
You can drive this boat. I don't all care. Right. You want to play it now? Play it now.
They're walking over to the instruments again. Every time they walk up and start playing, I just want to turn to you and go, happy anniversary, babe.
Fuck yourself.
You're listening to non-member-supported Nerdist Podcast.
Will you call me your baby when you're holding my hand? But the way that you hurt me, I just don't understand. Will you say that you need me like an ocean needs sand? But the way you mistreat me, I just don't understand. Well, you know that I love you. Just don't.
fantastic.
Thanks.
That was Spoon playing.
I just always want to do like the NPR thing. Because I feel like when there's a live performance here, it just feels like it should be
really delicate and reverent.
Yeah.
But also like bassy and leaning into the microphone. There's a certain,
it is a very certain.
Lots of that sound.
There's so much mouth noise.
I was listening to KCRW the other day, and I like got to the point where I was so hyper focused on that sound that I started having like a fucking freak out. It's like this.
It will make you.
Someone
crazy.
Get this woman a drink of water,
yeah. Or get shittier mics, please.
Turn the condenser off.
Yeah, I ended up turning it off.
So,
yeah.
What are some rules? Do you think they? Obviously, because you're at all your shows, how would you like the audience to comport itself? Because I feel like sometimes audiences come to a show and they feel like, hey, I've paid money, you better fucking entertain me. And you kind of go, all right, you just have a small job and your job is to just be open to being invested
fucking
in the show.
Watch the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So are there things that you would say to an audience, if you're going to come to a Spoon show, try to keep this in mind to make the show as pleasurable for everyone?
Well, you know, every performer wants the audience to get something back from them. You know, it's more fun when you do, when you can feel like, oh, we're both here, we're both present, something's
right.
happening here. So you know, volume helps, clapping, moving around. don't stand with your back to the audience right at the front of the stage. That happens sometimes.
Don't text. Don't make Facebook.
Yeah,
posts,
yeah, right? Yeah. But. Yeah, it is a thing, you know. Like they're judging us, but we're judging them too.
I want to know what the. You should say that during the show.
Yeah.
You think you're judging us? We're also judging you.
We're the abyss looking back, friends.
Yeah. Abyss to abyss. I want to try to figure out what the actual number is. Like some audiences, very rarely, but occasionally you will get an audience that just isn't great as a group. Together,
yes, exactly.
They just shouldn't hang out together.
Right.
But I feel like.
Remember at a Divine Fit show, someone got bit?
What?
Do you remember? That guy got bit.
No, I don't remember that.
This girl bit a dude in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah?
Just,
yeah.
Like, in a fight, or?
She, like, got mad that he was, like, he, like, moved in front of her or something. I don't know.
Oh, it was then
they weren't there together. They were not there together.
And
she bit him. She got kicked out.
Oh, yeah?
And
yeah.
Now they're happily married.
I missed that.
Yeah,
there is a happy ending to this.
I bit him at a show, and then we get together. But I feel like there's a number of people that can tip an audience, and I don't know what that number is. And I would really love to figure it out. But because an audience really does take on, they really do become this unified, throbbing mass. But at some point, there are micro leaders in each section, and I can't figure out.
I think there's a size to energy ratio, too, where you want that sweet spot. Where, like, the bigger it is, the more it's got to push up. And sometimes you're in that, not for the huge venues, but, like, the medium-sized ones. Like, you guys have done the Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
Fonda, I think, is the perfect tricky venue. Because I've definitely been to shows there where it's ecstatic, and then other times where it was a little too big for what was happening there.
Hmm.
Also, a little-known secret, it sounds horrible on that stage.
Yeah, it really
always.
Does.
I can imagine.
It sounds bad?
Always.
What is it? Is it just because of the way the
I think it's the stage is hollow.
Yeah,
it's like not,
there's just some unfortunate combination of effects there. It's just it does not sound good.
I don't know.
And those are things that you can't really say when you're on stage. Like, guys, it doesn't sound weird up here.
they want to see you do a good show,
right.
And that is your duty, you know,
right?
At all costs. Do you find yourself if you have a sometimes you'll get like a section of an audience is really great, but then like the other side. They're just not having it for some reason. And do you tend to play to the section that's doing better, or do you play to the section that's not to try to like pull them in?
I think about Jim Eno, our drummer. He always focuses on the ones that love us, right?
Uh-huh.
And my inclination has always been to go out and try to get the attention of the ones that don't, right? But. Sometimes you just can't. I mean, it's easier to focus on the ones that are right there.
Thank you, mezzanine.
Yeah.
The other thing that I've learned is that the narrative that's in your head about people or what they're thinking or enjoying is not always the case. That sometimes you learn, like, some people just enjoy things with less energy.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, like some guy in the audience that you thought was hating the show come on and go, hey, man, that was really great. And it's like, why didn't you fucking do anything during the game? You know, but they just don't.
Right.
They just express themselves differently than you express themselves. And you go, oh, yeah, I was putting me onto that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Like the people that lose their minds at shows, they're not necessarily the kind of people that we would sometimes, you know, like they're weirdos, you know. Like I don't go to shows and do hippie dances or whatever, but sometimes when you see someone doing this obnoxious dance, it's like, oh, okay, somebody's feeling it, you know.
Yeah.
It feels good, but that's not me. I'm probably a little more reserved.
I'm probably standing closer to the back.
Yeah,
except when I saw Queens of the Stone Age recently.
You stood in the front?
Yeah, I stood in like the very front. It's too good.
But yeah, that's a good point. Even the people that are loving it obsessively may not be giving you what you want, right? They just are a little more chill.
And then you have to sort of... I think a lot of it has to do with releasing expectations and not trying to control... Not trying to micromanage or control the situation too much. I think you go crazy if you're trying to control everything.
Mm.
Hopefully you get to a certain point where you go like, well, you know, this is how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they do. And hopefully it works. And, you know.
Yeah. You hope it works out. You hope that the chemistry's there.
I think you go Pink Floyd the Wall and send armed, uniformed goons into the crowd until they give you what you want.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That seems like a really important line item to have in your touring budget. Goons.
Uniformed
just
goons.
Just a truck full of equipped and uniformed goons. Are you good at performing if you're in a bad mood? Or if you're, like, is performing an escape for you? Or does it stick in the back of your head when you're on stage? If you're if something shitty has happened, or if you got in an argument with someone, or if you're bummed, or... Can you put it off, or does it stick with you?
Yeah, usually I can put it off. I mean, usually you hope that that kind of thing doesn't happen 2 minutes before you go on stage.
Right.
But if something's happened that day, there's this whole process of getting ready for a show. Some of it involves eating, right? And some of it involves, you know, at a certain time and just getting your headspace so that by the time you're about to walk on stage, you're there. And I think you can get – I personally can push that out.
Yeah.
Because I do enjoy the shows. I love doing shows, and they're no fun when you're not there in the right way. You know?
Right.
And you have the choice. Are you going to be in there in the right way? Are you going to be there and like be enjoying it, or are you going to be obsessing over some detail?
Are you good at enjoying success, do you think?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, do you appreciate it when it's happening, or do you appreciate? Because I feel like there's a way to appreciate stuff in a moment, and then other times you don't really appreciate. You appreciate things retrospectively, where you go, "Oh yeah, that was a really good thing that happened." But in the moment, you're just super focused on what you're like, what's going on, like what you have to do, and putting out fires and everything.
I don't know. This band existed for a long time when it was very unsuccessful, and so when we started getting even the most small steps of success. And they did come slowly and gradually, and I kind of felt like every step of the way we were appreciating that, like, okay, hey, we're not losing money on when we go out and do a show, tour, or, you know, we've sold 1,200 copies of our record this week. That was at some point that was a huge deal, like that really made us happy, you know. So every step of the way, it got a little better, and I think we do appreciate it. Yeah, I think that having those rough years, some good came out of it.
I think a lot of good comes out of that stuff because you don't. I mean, if you release one record and it's like you sold a million copies, I don't know. How do you know?
Yeah, where
how
do you go from that?
Where do you go from there? And how do you appreciate that? And how do you I feel like all of the and they're not. They're not like failure years. It's just like building years. And
right.
if you don't have that, you don't really have a foundation. You know, and then how great if after a few records, like something blows up, and then people all of a sudden have this catalog of stuff to rediscover.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have that before.
Right.
I don't know if it's the same. I mean, it's not really the same with. I just compare everything to stand-up because that's all. I don't know music. I just know stand-up, and I think there's a lot of fun parallels between what we do. Like even just tonally in the way we approach audiences, just like your tools are a little bit different than mine, but ultimately it's the same. Like, you're just trying to form a relationship in an hour,
right,
with an audience and communicate as quickly as possible.
I think that it must be hard as a comedian, though, that you've got your material, and you know it's only really good for a year or two, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, people that come see us, they want to hear those songs that they know. Right?
Exactly.
It seems like that would be
keeps you on
a
your
lot
toes.
Of work.
It keeps you on your toes.
Yeah.
And you know, when you write your first like hour of material, you're like, aha, this is the culmination of my life's work. And then right. after that, you're like, I got to do this again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I got to do it again. And so
immediately after.
Yeah. And, you know, in any, there's really only a couple of comedians that went beyond like three albums and continued to do well. But if you're a band, it's sort of like you really could, your 14th album could all of a sudden like, you know, right. like, and that's not as common in the comedy community.
We're having to go and write a new album's worth of material, but the cool thing is that we can go do a show and have these public performances where you can draw on, you know, a whole, whatever, in our case, 20 years of work, you know, and I don't see comedians having that same.
No, we don't get that. We don't get that same luxury, but it's nice. I mean, it must be nice to know that If there were a weird situation where someone's like, get on stage and play right now, you guys could get up and be like, all right, let's just, you know, we could bang out through something without having to rehearse anything.
Exactly.
That's kind of a nice comforting feeling. Are you guys married? You're not. Well, you're young. You're still
I'm
like
not allowed to date yet.
Damn it.
No, I'm not married. Neither one of us is married.
No.
There's a couple married guys in the band, Jim and Rob.
For a brief second, I thought you meant they together were married.
I thought so, too.
No. So you guys are just dating.
And we're not.
bad comic reflex. Do you... is it hard? I would imagine it must be really hard to maintain a relationship on the road if you're gone for, you know, almost a year at a time.
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah.
And what percentage you must have
experienced that yourself?
Well, I'm never on the road. I don't go on the road for like a long chunk of time. I'm always back and forth.
Right.
So I'm here during the week, and then I go on the weekend, and then, you know, a lot of times I could, you know, take that person with me, which is kind of nice. But you guys are on tour buses, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And you're essentially living a mobile life.
Yeah. If you're dating a doctor or something, then that's not something you can't bring them out on the tour bus with you.
No, because where else are you going to get the meds, man?
Right.
That's the perfect person to bring out on the road. No, I don't. Yeah,
it ain't easy.
It isn't. And I wonder if I feel like the type of person that actually could be a significant other in a relationship with a touring performer is a very specific type of person. I would imagine a very patient person.
Yeah. and a person that desires a certain type of relationship and maybe a certain amount of time alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had certain girlfriends that hated coming out and being on tour because, I don't know, there's just something about the chemistry. Some women love it, and then some of them, they just like, it makes them feel like, okay, what am I doing here?
You know? Right.
Right.
Some of them are more up for that than others.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, it's just, there aren't really like comedy groupies. But if you're single and you're a comedian, there are comedy groupies. But it feels a little more common in your field than it would be in mine.
I don't know. Maybe.
No comment.
Let me put it this way. I've never hooked up with a groupie.
Really?
Never.
All those years?
Yeah. Well, I've been in relationships forever.
Oh, that's true.
I just jump from relationship to relationship.
Oh, my mind. Chris Hardwick and Stacey Jacks.
And now I'm single, and I don't know what the fuck to do. Like, I don't know how
long you've been single?
I guess, what is it now? Maybe 5 weeks, 6 weeks?
Oh, this is fresh.
It's still, yeah. I keep thinking like it happened a long time ago, but when I say it out loud, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that just happened. That's still a new thing. What about you?
I'm not in one now.
You're not in one now?
Yeah, yeah.
And how long has it been?
About 9 months.
So you're kind of used to it now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's hard. I think the breakups get harder the older you get.
because you get you kind of get more, and because when you're young, you're like, oh, these are just, you know.
Yeah, I think there's stronger attachments and bonds form the older you get.
Right. You know, I feel like it's time to write a breakup song. We are that pacing tiger cage at the zoo with all eyes are just upon us.
I'm listening.
And we're just paranoid. We're sort of, you're like, people are watching me, but I'm alone.
Oh, man, this guy's going to strike.
I got... I had a tiger girlfriend back on a savanna somewhere, but we had to split up because long-distance relationships don't work in the wild.
He travels from zoo to zoo.
Zoo to zoo, yeah. Yeah, man. I don't know. This might be one of those on the nose.
Love tiger!
You can use that if you want. Do you have relatives that say that to you? You can use that if you want. Oh, yeah. Thanks.
You must.
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah. I do have relatives like that. They'll say something.
This will be great for your act.
Yeah.
Love it. Love it every time.
No, I just saw that on a... But my dad, for the longest time, was convinced that the phrase... I would call him and I go, "What do you? How's it going?" And he goes, "Same shit, different day." You could put that on a bumper sticker if you want. And I go, well, first of all, thanks. Second of all, no.
He thought he made that up?
I don't know if it's any thought that he made it up, but I guess he just sort of thought that he stumbled on the bumper stickering of it.
Mm.
That he thought like that was his. Yeah. It was like no one had put. But I guarantee you, if you went to like a truck stop off the I-40 somewhere between, you know, Tulsa.
Anywhere.
That if you went into a truck stop, there would be a same shit, different day. And then a bunch of truckers with like 64-ounce coffees like, that's the truth. Don't I know it? Well, I'm going to get back on the road and stick my dick in this hot donut so I feel like I have some human contact left in the world.
How did we get here?
I don't know. I think it's the... I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's a combination of actually talking about like things that really matter and then kind of feeling like, I'm not comfortable with that. And then I'm going to make a joke about a trucker fucking a donut.
Right.
That's what it is. It's just sort of constantly... I feel like the older you get, I don't know if you get better at staying a step ahead of your brain or if you get worse at staying a step ahead of your brain. What do you think?
I think I get better.
You get better at
it? Yeah.
You're not going to catch me, brain. Nice try.
I imagine that's the last thing you say before you go to bed.
I know. Right as a single tear just dribbles down the... You're not going to get me tonight, brain. It's the hardest thing about a breakup or a loss or whatever is that you can have a fine day and then your dreams just fucking attack you.
Ooh.
And you're like, why? I felt fine.
Mm. Or that you wake up in the morning before everything that's going on hits you again, before you remember everything.
Well, that's the, yes, which I always liken to, it's basically like someone is dumping like hot liquid reality onto your brain. Ooh. Before you wake up and you're like, oh, it's sunny outside, and then gloop, and then it's just like you just feel it like, oh, and it just sinks into all the levels of your brain. Or if you have this idea of like, there's this thing you can play called morning anger rodeo, and if you are with a significant other and you fight the night before, it's how long can you, for lack of a better term, spoon that person in the morning before they remember like, oh yeah, we're not talking right now.
I called it hate snuggling.
No, but you're not allowed. Yeah. You don't get to stay in the...
Well, you're just staring at the back of the person's head.
Yeah.
Just,
We're gonna snuggle. Did it get too real?
Let's get realer.
Yeah.
All right. Well, fine. What do you get real? You
gotta
talk about. Come on. Let's do it.
No. I can't get realer. I can't go there.
I can't. I know. Me too. It's a defense mechanism. But I don't. But I have the comedy defense mechanism. What's your defense mechanism?
I just get up there and play a song. You know. Then I don't have to say anything new.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Do you feel like that's sort of a general musician credo? Is like my songs speak for me.
Well. It is easy to just go up there, and it's scripted, right?
Yeah.
The parts that are spontaneous are not with the words, right? You know.
Right.
I guess Bradford Cox is good at that, though. Coming up with shit on the spot, but yeah, I think that having a script makes it a lot easier.
Because you can disappear into that if you need to.
Yeah, you're not expected to come up with new content, at least lyrically.
Right.
Yeah.
the Spoon All-Star Improv Jam, where you're like, I need a location, and then an occupation, and then you just start playing a song. Do you think you guys can improvise a song?
Could we improvise a song? Musically, yeah. But lyrically is a little harder for me. I know people that can do that, but... Alex, can you do that?
No.
Yeah.
You know Reggie Watts?
No, but yes.
In action, like...
Yeah. Something he could pull off.
Yeah.
He just did At Midnight.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
was he on it?
Like, yeah, just 2 hours ago.
Watching just... Because, like, I played music for a long time before I did comedy and was the worst at just, like, oh, I'll just mumble some things incoherently because I like this riff and don't feel like writing lyrics.
Right.
And then, like, watching Reggie, who actually, like, can take shit that you had a conversation about a minute ago and then work it into lyrics, is head exploding.
One of the most frustrating things about Reggie is I was in a musical comedy duo, and we toured with Reggie in 2004 all up the West Coast to 17 people max in each venue. And Reggie... would break out these really brilliant sounding things, but he didn't like to repeat stuff. So he would hit, it was sort of like the music trap of, you'd hear something one night and be like, fuck, I can't wait to hear that again. And he just wouldn't do it because he just didn't want to, or he forgot it.
I think bootleggers don't follow him around more.
They
like
should.
The kind of people who go to like jam band shows and somebody doesn't just track him with those. That's not, there's not Reggie Watts bootlegs.com.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, so many good things that you're just never going to hear again.
Are you even thinking about, after this, like, what's number 9 going to be? Or are you just focused on record number 8?
Yeah, I'm just focused on 8 for now.
Does it eat away with you when people are just like, so when's the next one? Right after you're done with one?
You just did that.
Yeah. I like to do both.
I don't get asked
at
that often.
It's a two-hander.
It's all right. I can deal with it.
They already said they have like 50 songs that are in various stages of development.
I'm trying to get us a scoop, boss.
Thanks. I like it when you call me boss. That's right. So you said there were just 2 songs?
Yeah. We're prepped for 2. Today.
You're prepped for 2. Okay. Yeah. Nope. That 2. I am thankful that you even did 2 songs here. That we
Thanks
were able to trick
us.
You into giving us this in Swing House. This is where we did the Ben Folds one.
Yeah, and the Brendan Small too.
And the Brendan Small.
Oh, too. You don't do it here every week.
No. It's only when we can convince someone to give us a private concert that we come to Swing House. Usually, we record at the TV studio where I do the TV show. So, but this is a nice treat for us because I don't know.
Although, I do think a drum kit would sound amazing in the room we record in because it's just this brick room that's just echoey as fuck. And every time I'm in there, I'm just like, God, a drum set would kill in here.
At this TV studio?
At the TV studio.
Yeah.
It's this tiny office room. But like,
it's the worst room for audio.
Just terrible.
On the entire property.
Except for giant John Bonham drums would sound huge in there.
But it's good to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you too.
And I hope you had a nice time. And you know, and thanks for getting a little real on the show. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, man. It's my pleasure.
It's good too.
Yeah.
Every once in a while.
Thanks for having us on.
No, good to see you.
I really enjoyed. We hadn't really figured out how we were going to play like... solo acoustic songs yet, so this was a good exercise for us.
And do you feel like aha, we got it?
Yeah, we kind of got it. We're gonna go do one in Seattle this next week, so we're good to go. Yeah.
So They Want My Soul is the album. It's August 5th, available where music is sold digitally. Are there still record stores, Kyle? I know there's Amoeba.
We're gonna go get them vinyl copies of things.
But did you guys put out a vinyl edition?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Spoon, man. You're going to go get a Spoon record on vinyl.
Can you explain to me why record players are like hundreds of dollars?
Because you want really good audio quality in it, so you got to get high-quality parts.
Or is it they know because hipsters will pay hundreds of dollars for
both.
A record player?
It's both.
You know what? I would just be happy with that old, like...
I got, like, a... Mine's only, like, $100.
Do you remember when we... Well, not when you were young, but when I was young, you could buy something that looked like a truck, and it had a needle in it, and you'd set it on the record, and it would drive around in circles, and it had a little speaker on top of it?
I forgot. I know, I missed that.
You never saw that?
The sound
quality was terrible. And I think you also risked...
Oh, so the record wasn't moving. It just drove
around. Yeah. The record would stay still, and then this little truck had a needle on it and a speaker, and it would drive around in circles toward the center.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of times completely demolish the record in the process. But I would pay hundreds of dollars for that.
You didn't have one?
No. I feel like that's...
Do you have one of those plastic carry case ones?
No.
Those are my favorite. Jack White has one of those now that's yellow plastic, and you just put it in, it like hangs out the side.
Oh, man. All right. I think I know that there is a hole. The hole in my soul is shaped like a truck with a record needle on it.
Wouldn't it be great if that's what gets you back into vinyl hardcore? Like you're just buying records to put your truck on?
Dude, I'm actually surprised that there's not like some weird hipster movement already of just that. And then just deciding like, oh, look, it's the General Lee. And like everyone fucking puts like whatever sort of weird ironic childhood memory they have, some pop culture reference.
Are you listening, Portland?
I would buy one if it were in the shape of a DeLorean or the Ghostbusters vehicle.
That sounds like a product to sell. To Comic-Con.
I've become my dad. You should make that.
Get out of my head, Dad. Enjoy a burrito, everyone else.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.